Стенвал. Первые часы агрессии.
В зону конфликта вошли российские
президент
войска.
Президент поручил правительству срочно оказать гуманитарную
помощь. Россия пришла на помощь гражданам республики.
80. Я обязан защищать жизнь.
They were getting hacked by Russia before it was cool. They were the target of Kremlin information attacks before it became trendy. They had their territory occupied by pro-Moscow proxies before we ever even heard of little green men. In many ways, Georgia was a testing ground for and a harbinger of what we now call hybrid warfare. And this week in Tbilisi, officials, security analysts, and policy experts gathered to discuss the lessons learned and the way forward. So how do you provide security in an insecure zone? Hello from Tbilisi, Georgia, and welcome to a special on-the-road edition of the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in our Tbilisi bureau is David Rakviashvili, Secretary of Georgia's National Security Council. Welcome, David.
Hello, Brian.
And also joining us is Michael Carpenter, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and currently the director of the Penn Biden Center in Washington. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. I've long wanted to have you on. So the three of us have spent the past couple of days here in Tbilisi at the strategic dialogues. And while ostensibly this event was aimed at sparking a discussion about Georgia's security, for me it was actually about a much broader theme. How can the countries in the so-called gray zone, Georgia, Ukraine, and Moldova, be made secure and integrated into the Euro-Atlantic community in the face of Russian revanchism, given the fact that NATO membership is clearly not in the cards? Now, Mike, you worked on these issues at the Pentagon, in the White House as a foreign advisor to former Vice President Joe Biden. You've worked on them in the State Department. And like me, I know you're an optimist by nature. Let's take as a given the obvious. Georgia and Ukraine are not going to be NATO members in the near or even the medium-term future. Given that, can these countries be secure, and can they be integrated into the West?
Well, they can be made more secure, which is the most important thing. And so what we focused on when I was at the Pentagon was trying to reform Georgia's military to make it more ready, more capable, more able to defend itself, and to adopt what some have called sort of the hedgehog approach, to make Georgia as indigestible as possible for a potential Russian occupation in the future or any other kind of Russian military action here. And so the goal was really to sort of beef up their capabilities. If they don't have NATO's Article 5 guarantee, there's only so much you can do in terms of putting in place the hardware of the NATO military alliance, but there's a lot you can do on the margins to make them more secure.
And in terms of integrating into the larger Western Euro-Atlantic community, I mean, the defense is one thing, the positive agenda is another.
Yeah, so there's a lot that can be done that is short of actual membership in NATO or the EU. I mean, let's take NATO. Before you get to the point at which you become a member, there are a lot of reforms that need to happen. There are a lot of changes to one's military that need to be carefully planned and executed over the course of many, many years. That includes making equipment and procedures interoperable with the rest of the alliance. But it also means changing the way militaries do business. And so Georgia has come part of the way. But our sort of goal here was to make sure that when the political moment is ripe for Georgia to join NATO, whether that's in 5 years, 10 years, or 20 years, that they are ready to join immediately. And so we want to do the work now, all the preparatory spade work, so that when that moment comes, mm-hmm. when the political moment is there, that they are able to join.
Yeah, no, this was a point I actually raised during the discussions this week, is that sooner or later, Russia's going to weaken. They're going to look inward. This has happened. If the cycles of Russian history teach us that this happens periodically. The last time this happened was the late 80s, early 90s. And the last time this happened, the West used the opportunity to provide for the security of the Visegrad Four and the Baltic states. This is going to happen again. But the Visegrad Four and the Baltic states were ready to join on day one when that door opened, when that window of opportunity opened. David, you were one of the key drivers of the Tbilisi strategic discussions. And as I said, one of the things that came out of these meetings was that Georgia needs to take steps on its own in the short to medium term to enhance its own security and to be ready to join on day one when that window does eventually open. What do you think Georgia needs to do?
Well, thanks, Brian. There are two dimensions I believe we can differentiate. One is the practical dimension, the other one would be the political. I believe in the practical dimension, Georgia needs to continue what it does, which means it's very strong cooperation with the NATO and bilateral cooperation, as Mike suggested. The Georgian Defense Readiness Program is one of the most promising engagements that we are now entering, and this is going to increase our capabilities for the territorial defense. We have a lot of engagement with the NATO. Another thing we clearly need to pursue is strengthening the national instruments of power, including our resilience, which becomes not only the buzzword but kind of a cornerstone in fighting the hybrid threats in the modern world. On a political level, I believe that, you know, and again, Georgia does so, we need to work very actively with the capitals in Europe and in America, because the security of Georgia is no longer and cannot be considered only a security of Georgia itself. The security of Georgia has implications, the wider Black Sea and wider region, and clearly it has the implication also on the European security. Before the Georgia becomes the NATO member, there should be very active steps in order to activate Georgia's engagement in the Black Sea dialogue, which NATO is more and more engaged in, and finding the bilateral and multilateral solutions that will help Georgia's agenda to move up on the agenda of the political decision makers in the capitals.
So in a sense, you need to convince Western capitals that this is not just a small, faraway country of which we know little.
I think that that has been already acknowledged. I think that, you know, the storyline of Georgia being attacked in 2008 and then the continuation of that aggression from Russian Federation into the Crimea and the eastern Ukraine, and then reaching as far as the Western capitals, you know, right, meddling with the political processes there, clearly suggests that it is a mistake to think about these things in the terms of 19th century real politics.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've long tried to make this argument that we need to pay very close attention to what happens in these countries, because it is often a harbinger of what's going to happen to us down the road. But beyond that, I do believe that our security is deeply, deeply connected to your security. But that is not a mainstream view in most Western capitals, is it, Mike?
No, it's not. I mean, there's a lot of fear that if the United States or other NATO allies move troops or military infrastructure here into Georgia, that somehow that would be provocative. I fundamentally disagree with that. I think the more secure these countries become, the less of an incentive Putin has to either foment some sort of revanchist military intervention or to undertake hybrid sort of gray zone measures, which frankly right now I think are the biggest threat to the entire region here in Georgia, but also across Western Europe and the United States.
Now, we just listened to David kind of lay out some of the steps he thinks Georgia needs to take. What steps would you add to those, or would you add to anything? What is needed to basically convince people in Western capitals of this?
Well, I think David laid out a very cogent agenda for how Georgia should proceed. I think there needs to be a diplomatic angle here where Georgia is talking to all of its NATO partners about the steps that it's taking and how they can help. And there already is a very robust effort underway as a result of the Wales NATO summit. It's called the Substantial NATO-Georgia Package. It consists of a variety of measures across 13 different issue areas where various NATO allies are helping Georgia, tutoring Georgia, providing capabilities in various different areas, but also, frankly, learning from Georgia about some of the hybrid threats that they've encountered. So I think that's one step. And then the other step is really reforming internally, reforming, as I said earlier, the military, but then also reforming the whole national security strategy to look at this complex that goes all the way from high-end military intervention down to information warfare, cyber, and some of the more covert, less kinetic measures, if you will.
Yeah, no, this is something also I was raising at during the discussions, is that we need to, when we look at, we talk about hybrid warfare, hybrid attacks, this is the buzzword of the decade, so to speak. We really are talking about two different things. On one hand, we're talking about efforts to make to prepare the battlefield for kinetic action. And we've witnessed this in Georgia in 2008, which was preceded by a whole series of activities through late 2007, prior to the Russian invasion in August of 2008. And of course, we saw this in Ukraine prior to the annexation of Crimea and the intervention in the Donbas. That's one kind of hybrid war. But then there's the kind of hybrid war like that the Lisa case illustrates, or the interference in the U.S. or the French presidential elections illustrates. I do not think, call me crazy, but I don't think that Russia is, even this regime, is preparing for any kinetic action against Germany, France, or the United States. This is more of a long-term, it's almost hybrid for hybrid's sake, rather than hybrid to prepare the battlefield for future kinetic action. It's a long-term political destabilization campaign. Georgia has experienced both of these things. Georgia is one of those countries where a hybrid situation could be preparation for kinetic warfare, or it could be just a long-term destabilization campaign. It could be very fluid, right? And in this sense, I mean, I think Georgia has a lot to teach us about this. Like I said, kind of flippantly at the opening, you were getting hacked before it was cool. But I think there's real value in that, because I think you can this is an area where Georgia can be a provider and enhancer of Western security. David, what do you think Georgia can offer us? What are the lessons learned from what you've been experiencing what we now call hybrid war for better part of the last 25 years?
Yeah, that's a very accurate assumption and assessment of the situation. First of all, the hybrid warfare, it's a totally cynical but a very smart approach. It allows to exercise minimum pressure and gain maximum benefits. And that is not a secret, and you know, Russia's never made this a secret, and there is this famous
Gerasimov
doctrine, which basically argues that utilize everything but the military, and that's the last resort.
Interestingly enough, the Gerasimov doctrine, when it talked of hybrid war, Gibridnaya Vayna, it was describing what Russia believes the West is doing to Russia. It wasn't a blueprint for what Russia should be doing. It was describing.
Well, it was both.
Inferred that we should do this too. Where it was very cleverly worded document.
Yeah. Well, Georgia has never experienced the hybrid war from West,
right?
But it clearly has experienced 25 years of hybrid.
Well,
war
Russia
with
would
Russians.
Argue the Rose Revolution was a Western hybrid attack to interfere in the internal affairs of Georgia. That.
And you look back to Georgia's history, and you see that after we emerged as a post-Soviet failed state, and you see how little Russians needed in order to control the situation in Georgia. They have had the ministers in the law enforcement agencies being appointed from Moscow, so they didn't need any further activities.
This was pre-Rose Revolution,
right? And then you see the way Georgia progresses, and stronger Georgia becomes, the pressure increases. The complexity of the hybrid war increases. You see that Georgia is losing territories temporarily, but you see how Russians then are trying to activate and leverage the Central Georgia government with the frozen conflicts, eternally arguing that the key and the solution to the conflict is in the Moscow. And you see the storyline of Georgia of past 25-6 years, and you clearly see all the methodology that is applied by Russians is the kind of a chrestomatic, and now those methodologies are studied today by the Western universities. So I agree, if you look at the Georgia's case, you analyze what were the aims in a given momentum for Russians, and in a bigger picture, what were the methods, who were the actors, what was the context, how much the West was engaged, and you see clear linkage with that. The less West is engaged in Georgia, more pressure we have from Russia. And all these storylines, they show one particular picture that, the very existence of Georgia as the strong and sovereign country is the provocation for Russian regime in general.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've long argued Russia's not threatened by anything the West does. The Putin regime is threatened by what the West is. Russia is not threatened by anything Georgia does, but the Putin regime finds the existence of an independent Georgia and a sovereign Georgia and a sovereign Ukraine, for that matter, as an existential threat. This is a mistaken view, but they view it this way. Mike, what do you think we can learn from the Georgian experience in this? I mean, now that we in the West are facing what we are now calling hybrid warfare.
Yeah, well, I think the main lesson here is that if we don't help our partners in this part of the world to stand up to these sorts of measures, and by the way, I distinguish between active measures, which are some of the more covert types of operations that you say, that, as you rightly pointed out, don't necessarily lead to kinetic conflict, and unconventional warfare tactics, which generally speaking are designed to prepare the battlefield for some sort of kinetic action. But the line is very blurred. Mm-hmm. And the lesson here is, unless we strengthen the societies, the government capacity, provide the capabilities to these countries to be able to confront these threats primarily from Russia, but sometimes they come from non-state actors as well, then this contagion will spread. I mean, we saw the war first the cyber attack in Estonia in 2007, then there was a hot war here in Georgia when Russia invaded in 2008. Which was preceded by a cyber attack, which, by the way, was preceded by little green men as well. They weren't called that at the time. It seems anachronistic, but let's remember there were Cossacks that were flooding into South Ossetia before August 7th, before the Russian troops showed up. In fact, Russia had staged journalists in Skinvali anticipating that something was going to happen. So we've seen this playbook before. We were a little bit uncertain in the West what was going on back then in 2008. Hopefully now we're a little bit more attuned to what this looks like. But the chief lesson here is that we need to help these countries to withstand this kind of pressure, because Russia is fundamentally right now a revanchist regime. The Kremlin has a neo-imperial ambition. And if we don't check this neo-imperial ambition, we're just simply going to fan the flames of these sorts of actions, maybe not in Georgia, maybe not in Ukraine, but in some other country. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Russia desires to control the post-Soviet region for exactly the reason you mentioned, because it Western influence, whether it's NATO or whether it's the EU, undermines the Kremlin's power and privilege, and also their corrupt rent seeking, which is part of that. So we need to get stronger in this region.
No, thinking back as you were talking, Mike, I was remembering the information campaign that was going on prior to the August 2008 invasion of Georgia. And if you remember, I mean, before we heard about Ukrainian fascists, we all learned about Georgian genocide. Right? Remember this?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there was a Russian information campaign that the Mikhail Saakashvili had become unhinged, and that Georgia was committing genocide in South Ossetia. Now, reasonable people can have different opinions about the former president of Georgia. We're going to discuss him a little bit in the second half of today's program. But I think we can all agree, his best friends and worst enemies, that he didn't commit genocide in South Ossetia. But yet, this was out there, this whole thing. But in it didn't convince the world that this was happening, but it did manage to make people assign some of the blame for that conflict on Georgia. I mean, to me, it was always amazing debates about who started the war. I always feel the need to point out that Georgian troops never left Georgian territory. So how the hell do you start a war with a neighbor when your troops never left your territory? But yet, this was a debate. This was debated by serious people in the West who really started this. So I think in that sense, the information campaign was extremely successful. I wanted to touch, before we move into the second half, I wanted to touch on something that I think is kind of at the center of this whole hybrid thing here in Georgia and in Ukraine. I think Georgia's done a good job on this, and that's corruption. I know, Mike, you and I both raised this yesterday during the strategic discussions, that corruption is actually one, I think it's the linchpin of the whole Russian hybrid operation, whether it's hybrid preparing for kinetic or whether it's hybrid in terms of a long-term non-kinetic war, as we're seeing in the West. Corruption, as I like to say, is the new communism. Georgia did itself a lot of favors after the Rose Revolution in this regard. I mean, corruption went dramatically down in this country. Russia's also weaponized organized crime, and I think, again, the very brave decision to go after the Vordi Vzakonia, or the thieves in law in Georgia, I think had a strong impact on enhancing Georgia's security. Can you speak to this a little bit, David, and see what else does Georgia need to do along these lines?
Absolutely. Before going there, I just want to give you my kind of reading. What is the aim of Russia? And we can speculate about, you know, the grand picture and the spheres of influence. But in the on the kind of ground level, what they need to have, it's a bardak. And everything that you've listed now, you know, the political corruption or the weaponizing criminal, it actually supports creating bardak. And that's the essence of the Russian warfare, basically, which has been the lifestyle of the Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union was bardak, ruled by the thieves and by the crooks and by, you know, authoritarian and KGB officers. So by actually, and that has been so well known methodology for the KGB, which has, or FSB, which then was the KGB, and before that was the Akhranka, you name, I mean, that, a very long history of the organization. But basically, these are the tools that over and over are used as well-tested instruments in Georgia and elsewhere in the post-Soviet Union, because you should not kind of forget that we've been there for not only 70 years, but before that we've been in Russian Empire for so long. So our social behavioristic is very well known to these guys. And they know how to bribe, you know, politicians. They know how to bribe, you know, or how to threaten people with the weaponized criminals. So I think that you very rightly laid down the list of the methodologies, and they still are there. We fight that. It's not easy, and I think that the key to success in fighting those weapons is only one, which is called democratization and building up the strong democratic institutions, state institutions, because the state institutions then already consolidate into much stronger power that can resist that influence.
No, I mean, I had an interesting conversation with some Estonian intelligence officers, and I asked them why Estonia was so successful, why they thought, because I do believe it was true, that Estonia has been so successful in basically inoculating itself as much as possible against these hybrid attacks when it's so small and so close to Russia and so vulnerable, yet they've made themselves so, not immune, but as immune as you can get. And it was very, it was like, well, we don't have oligarchs. It was just like this, it was like, and it's like, is it really that simple? We don't have oligarchs. Well, it's also that you have a very, they have a very transparent system with the e-government. It's very hard to be corrupt. But even in Estonia, you'll see attempts to weaponize organized crime. I don't know if you're familiar. It's an example I like to bring up a lot because I think it is so illustrative. There was a cigarette smuggling ring that was recently busted on the Estonian-Russian border. And the FSB was facilitating the smuggling of cigarettes in and out of Estonia. And the smugglers were effectively working for the FSB, doing surveillance of the Estonian border, reporting on the habits of Estonian border guards. And the FSB was helping facilitate the smuggling and getting a cut of this. But this wasn't just simple corruption. This wasn't just FSB officers lining their pockets. What they were doing was they were creating Chornaya, what the Russians call Chornaya Kassa, or the black cash box, unaccountable black cash that then you can use for all sorts of active measures all over the place. And if you multiply, this is one little cigarette smuggling ring. And incidentally, this was what Eston Kohver, the Estonian law enforcement officer who was kidnapped by the Russians on the Estonian side of the border, brought back into Russia and then charged with espionage, later released. This is what he was investigating. He was getting a little too damn close for it. But if you multiply, because call me crazy, but I don't think there's just one cigarette smuggling ring, and I think cigarette smuggling isn't the only illegal activity the FSB is aiding and abetting that organized crime is doing, and Russian organized crime is doing in Europe. If you multiply this, that's one hell of a big Chornaya Kassa, right? That's a lot of money for active measures, right? Now, Georgia did its best to shut this down in here. I mean, almost immediately after the Rose Revolution, you effectively arrested, if I'm not mistaken, all of the Voriv Zakonia on Georgian territory, correct?
Well, or they had to leave. Mm-hmm. That they had to fled the country.
And can we say that Georgia doesn't have an organized crime problem now? Or what? I mean, what has been the effect of this?
Well, I believe that this would be an exaggeration and this would be naivety to
I
think
I was provoking
that,
you into saying
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's fair. Fair enough. No, I think that, you know, when we talk about the hybrid threats and what we talk about the enemy that is, you know, attacking us with the hybrid methods, we should not forget one particular and I think critical component of the hybrid threats, it's us. And the way Georgians behave, the way Georgians develop the society or the state institutions, or the way how we change our approaches towards the crime, how the society is brave in countering these narratives and Homo Sovieticus beliefs, which still are very well found in the Georgian society, is going to be the critical consideration. And I unfortunately should admit that, you know, though we have been fighting to this evil, you still see that, you know, Georgia is attacked, and Georgia is, of course, on the crossroads. And by the way, we have those two occupied territories, mm-hmm. and it's kind of also the black holes for the, you know, proliferation of varieties of things, mm-hmm. including the, of course, crime. And by the way, there were the cases of the proliferation of the some enriched nuclear materials.
Right.
So, we are very successful. I would claim this became kind of the one of the cornerstones of Georgia's statehood building, fighting the organized crime. I believe because we understand to which extent we are infected with this disease and mm-hmm. how important it is to get rid of it for good. But I believe that we still have the kind of soft spots, and those are pressurized.
Mike, before we move on to the second part, anything to add here? I'd like to get your thoughts on all of this.
No, I think this is absolutely correct. I think the fact that Russia is able to combine both organized crime that is infiltrated by its intelligence services as a means to exert influence, but also to coerce political elites, economic elites, social leaders, media figures in foreign countries is sort of how they managed to subvert quietly the institutions of democracy and spread sort of a corrosive anti-democratic influence. And sometimes this goes, you know, look at the case of the coup d'etat that was attempted in Montenegro. Exactly. You know, they used far-right nationalist politicians and organized crime figures in order to try to perpetrate a coup that would have assassinated the sitting prime minister of that country. You know, so sometimes this can go to extreme lengths. In other cases, like with the abduction of Eston Kovar and in Estonia, it's one individual, but it's because that individual gets a little bit too close to their modus right. operandi, and they're fearful that he's going to reveal how the scheme operates. But this is fundamentally how active measures take place. Yeah. And you know, a lot of people in the West, unfortunately, are not up on how this works.
Yeah, no, as my normal podcast co-host Mark Galeotti likes to put it very eloquently, Russia's not a mafia state. It's a state with a nationalized mafia. And it uses that mafia to do all sorts of things that the state doesn't want its fingerprints on, whether it's smuggling weapons into the Donbass or bumping off troublesome dissidents in London. On that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the relationship between domestic politics and security in Georgia and Ukraine. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in our Tbilisi bureau is David Rakviashvili, Secretary of Georgia's National Security Council. And also joining us is Michael Carpenter, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and currently the director of the Penn Biden Center in Washington. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Миша!
Миша! Сегодня банда Порошенко! Я положу свою жизнь за пойти на Майдан! Сейчас же! Армия на нашей стороне! Ура!
So as we were discussing security issues here in Georgia, there were some dramatic events in Ukraine involving the former Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili. Ukrainian law enforcement attempted and embarrassingly failed to arrest Saakashvili after accusing him of colluding with a criminal group tied to ousted Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych. The whole thing was, I mean, we all were kind of following this on our smartphones yesterday as we were supposed to be paying attention to the discussions. We had Saakashvili threatening to jump off the roof of his apartment building. We had him bundled into a car by Ukrainian law enforcement. We had a supporter surrounding the car, and him being freed. We had him marching on the parliament, calling for the impeachment of current president Petro Poroshenko. I don't want to get into all the minutiae of the Saakashvili Poroshenko thing right now for a couple of reasons. I think it's going to sidetrack us from the real issues, and also. Yeah, programming note, we're recording this podcast on Wednesday and it's going to be published on Friday, and a lot can happen in this very fast-moving story. But what the whole Saakashvili thing taught me, I mean, is that we watched it as it threatened to destabilize Ukraine. As there was talk that Saakashvili may be extradited back here to Georgia, it may have destabilized Georgia. It reminded me, of the close relationship between domestic politics in these countries, in both of these countries, and their security. Here in Georgia, for example, as you know, David, a new constitutional reform will not only diminish the powers of the president, but it will eliminate the institution of the National Security Council, which you currently lead. I guess I want to start with Mike on this. I mean, how do you see the relationship between domestic politics and security in the Georgian and Ukrainian case? Because we certainly do see situations where, for domestic political reasons, and let's face it, we all have our domestic political squabbles going on, and we Americans are certainly not immune to that, but we often see these countries appearing to, from our vantage point, to shoot themselves in the foot for domestic. So how do you see the relationship?
Well, you know, I think domestic politics and national security are inextricably interwoven. And it is normal in democratic life to have parties articulating different visions, and sometimes that gets into some very heated debates. But when you have incidents like the one with Saakashvili in Ukraine, where, you know, he's standing on the top of a building and there's security agents that are lining the perimeter of the building and he's threatening to jump off, these sorts of things, they undermine the fabric, the political fabric of the nation, and they suit really only one actor, and that's Vladimir Putin. And we see the same thing in the United States. I mean, look at what Russia's primary goals were during its interference in the 2016 election. It was, of course, to support Donald Trump as one of the candidates, but more fundamentally, it was to undermine, to sow chaos within society, to set different groups of Americans against each other. And so we saw Russian bots and trolls, for example, on both sides of various divisive issues. Yeah. Pro-LGBT, anti-LGBT, we saw them, pro-Black Lives Matter movement, against the Black Lives Matter movement. Their goal was not to promote one particular ideology, it was to sow chaos within the system. And as I said, all democracies have a certain amount of deliberation, discussion, which can get, and sometimes rightfully should get, heated because the issues are important and people channel their passions into the political process. But that also can cross a line, and then foreign actors can take advantage of that to destabilize the institutions and to take advantage of the situation for their own purposes. And that's what Russia is doing in Ukraine right now.
But we're also seeing, I mean, another piece I was looking at yesterday, it looks like they're going to go after the Anti-Corruption Bureau in Ukraine. Now, this is
a travesty.
I mean, this seems to me as, like, talk about shooting yourself in the foot.
Well, this is the number one goal, I think, for Russia and Ukraine, is to have the political class fighting amongst each other and trying to undermine this one fledgling institution, right, which has a chance of truly fighting corruption in that country, which has seen endemic corruption now for 25 years and more. And so the fact that, you know, it was thanks to Western pressure, U.S. pressure, European pressure, and the IMF that they stood up this National Anti-Corruption Bureau. And now to see the political class at the very top going after this institution, trying to undermine it from the prosecutor general's office, from the intelligence services, is, as I said, it's a travesty. And it opens up simply more space for Russians and other hostile actors to undermine Ukrainian society.
Now, let's shift from Ukraine to Georgia and go to David here. I mean, as I was looking at these constitutional reforms, I mean, some of them make sense to me. Some of them look reasonable. Some of them look like, quite frankly, naked attempts of a power grab by the current ruling party, although reasonable people could differ about that. That's the way it looks for me. But the one bit that I don't get, and maybe you could help me out here, because I was scratching my head on this. Why on earth is the National Security Council being eliminated And how will this affect Georgia's security? Because it's remarkable to me. You're at war. I mean, you're effectively at war. 20% of your territory is occupied. How can anybody decide you do not need a National Security Council?
Well, let me start with picking up on what Mike was discussing. I think that the political processes, including the political process that led to the constitutional changes, would have to be aimed at strengthening the democracy. And we should clearly understand that the democracy is the critical component and the key element of Georgia's national power. And the national security actually rests on the democracy. That's why we are interesting to the rest of the civilized world. And non-democratic Georgia clearly will be interesting only for Russians. So in that extent, the whole process of the constitutional change clearly damaged that very perception of the democracy and conducting such a fundamental task to come up with a new document that should be an agreement of the whole society. And it was meant to be the very inclusive process. It was meant to accommodate the thoughts and views and ideas of varieties of stakeholders. And unfortunately, it ended up being the one-party document.
Right.
And that is something which I think was the core of this process, the key disadvantage of the Constitution, the whole story of the constitutional change. Now, going to the national security system, it also eliminated from the Constitution the National Security Council. And I do not want to go in or speculate about the motivation why this was done. But I can tell you the reasons that were openly named were that, you know, it is not possible to have the National Security Council in the parliamentary governance model, and that there was some kind of suggestions on the side of the Western experts, including the Venice Commission experts. Well, both arguments are, to me, totally groundless. And actually, the Venice Commission then wrote the letter to Georgia, and they've said that, you know, it's up to Georgians coming out of their national interest to set up and develop the national security structure which best suits the challenges. So I think that the whole attempt to justify why the National Security Council was abolished failed. Well, that said, we still will find ourselves in a year from now in a situation when there is no high political platform that can accommodate the discussion about the national security policies. The National Security Council would see the president and the prime minister and the head of the parliament and the two chairs of the parliamentary commission, the law enforcement agencies, everyone with a political weight that has a capacity, brains, to discuss the strategies and to come up and actually to also share the visions about how the national security should be provided to the country. There was a possibility that this would move, these competencies would move to the another agency that was under the Prime Minister, which is the State Security Council, but with the recent structural changes in the government, that organization has been abolished too. Now, we believe that these are not the final kind of final developments. We believe that there will be a voice of reason. And we believe that the national security structure should be reformed in a way that it best responds to whatever we've been here discussing, that
right.
The hybrid world that Georgia is, and I fully agree with you, we do not have a peace accord with Russians. It's just a ceasefire that
right.
Separated us. And Russia never have agreed to sign the non-use of force.
Right.
Mike is well aware of this. And the geography of terrorism is so expanded. And the tools and the methods of the hybrid war, including those that we've said weaponized crime, have an enormous capacity to evaluate or escalate from a regular criminal case into wider context, into the regional context. And I think that neglecting this is a big mistake. I think allowing Georgia not to have a strategic discussion about the National Security Council is a mistake, and I believe that sooner or later this will be understood and we will come up with a better and a more durable solution.
Yeah, like Mike, having worked at the highest, very high levels of U.S. government and the national security bureaucracy, what effect do you think not having a National Security Council will have on Georgia's security?
Obviously a very negative effect. I think, unfortunately, and I'm going to be a little less diplomatic than David here, but I think, unfortunately, this decision was taken for personalistic reasons. I think it was taken in order to decrease the power of the current president by the ruling coalition. I think it's unfortunate that they made this decision. I think it's very short-sighted. A Security Council like the one that David chairs is very important, regardless of who's in power in which office,
right,
in order to coordinate the whole of government approach to any kind of threat that you see. And increasingly, as we're facing hybrid threats, you need a whole of government
right.
approach, because you need to work on both the economic side, on the Ministry of Interior side, on the Ministry of Defense side.
Finance.
And not have finance, you know, and not law enforcement. Not having that coordinating body puts a country at a huge disadvantage.
So Georgia's security will be damaged by this in your I mean, this is my feeling.
Well, as David said, you know, we've not reached the end of the road yet. They're still deliberating, you know, what will happen. But if they do abolish any kind of coordinating agency, they will be at a huge disadvantage, and it will be deleterious.
All right, we're bumping up towards the end here, but there is one other thing I wanted to discuss. It's something I had raised a few times in yesterday's discussions, and that is the experience of the Baltic states. Right now, these are the only three countries that have gotten from point A, the Soviet Union, to point B, the European Union and NATO. How instructive is their experience for you? Because I've heard that, well, you can't really compare us to the Baltic states. They only had 40 years of communism. We had 70. They knew what independence was for a period. Their experience isn't relevant to us. And then others, but I keep saying, all right, yeah, but they are the only countries that have gotten, that have traveled that road that you're trying to travel. And I would add, they are more than willing to be helpful to you right now. You have to really admire the role the Baltics are trying to play inside NATO and inside the European Union with regard to the partnership countries. David, what do you think of this? As what can the Baltic states teach you?
Well, first of all, they perfectly well understand that the geography doesn't matter anymore. I mean, that they perfectly well understand that though they have the security umbrella and Georgia does not, they see a threat for Georgia and perceive a threat to Georgia as their own threat. And that's why they are leading every possible momentum to make Georgia's case up and make Georgia's case stronger and bring this to the attention of other capitals in European Union. Their success is extremely important for us because, first of all, we should remember that when they emerged and when they've joined the NATO and when they managed to break those doors and or force the other members to open those doors, they have had less than Georgia friends. So their courage is enormous, and their example is so much encouraging. I think that's the passion that they have and that they had is the number one that inspires Georgians and the Georgian state. Besides that, at every possible occasion, the way how they actually manage to get rid of the Soviet heritage, mental Soviet heritage, get rid of the Homo Soveticus, which is again a disease that is eating from within the society, is one of the most important examples. Very firm, not compromising the democracy, not compromising, quite to the contrary, increasing the rule of law, increasing the human rights, every possible rights, and defeating the Homo Soveticus by doing that. I think that's the critical considerations we should have.
Yeah, no, the joke that makes the rounds around the Baltics at the time, and if you do remember, the West was really not interested in bringing these countries into the NATO or the European Union at that time, and they just wouldn't take no for an answer. And as they said, we're going in the door, and if they throw us out the door, we're going to come in the window, and if they throw us out the window, we're coming down the chimney, right? And they eventually did it. They wouldn't take no for an answer. But the key, and this goes back to remarks I made earlier, they were ready. All the while, they weren't just saying, let us in. They were basically reforming as if they were in. So when the political moment finally did come, they could just walk through the door. Mike, what would you add to this? What can the Baltic experience
teach
us?
Well, I think the story of the Baltics is tremendously inspiring for all the reasons that you just said. But, you know, I would say Georgia also has the same sense of civic consciousness that is really widespread within society. And you have a tremendous political elite here. Although they are divided on partisan lines, there is so much common understanding of the ultimate end goals of where they want to be strategically in the West, with a democracy, with rule of law. And they've taken so many steps, as we've discussed, over the last 10, 15 years to get rid of organized crime, to get rid of petty corruption. There's still obviously a ways to go, but they are following in the path of their Baltic predecessors. And I think they're going to have every bit of success the same way the Balts did in the future. It's going to take a little bit longer because of Russia's war, because of Russia's occupation, which the Balts didn't have to undergo at the time. But, you know, I think Georgia is on the same trajectory sociologically, societally, attitudinally as the Baltic states. And so I'm an optimist.
Can I add something?
Sure.
I think another thing we could learn and should learn from Baltic states is how efficiently they find their geopolitical niche or the niche in the global economic or political affairs. And I think that's the one very important thing Georgia should also do.
Well, that's I love ending the podcast on an optimistic note. So that's we don't often get to do that, and that's exactly how I'm going to do it because that's all we have time for today. So I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in our Tbilisi bureau has been David Arakviashvili, Secretary of Georgia's National Security Council. Also joining us has been Michael Carpenter, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and currently Director of the Penn Biden Center in Washington. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening and fascinating discussion.
It was great to be with you.
Great to have you.
Great to be here.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog, and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.